Welcome to Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
And it's another episode of Mind Food Radio. How are you, Michael?
I'm good. How are you, Ben?
I'm very, very well. Another busy program today. Where have you been this week? Busy?
Look, I tell you, that final deadline, they just seem to get
the September issue.
I know. No. We've done the September. That's on sale now. October.
So it's always a month ahead, more or less.
It is. And a fantastic cover star. And in fact, we're going to be talking about her on today's show.
Fantastic. On today's program coming up, we're going to be talking with a man who survived Bali.
That's right. An absolute extraordinary story, Phil Britton. And, 10 years on and what he's gone on and managed to achieve. It's a must listen to interview. It's so powerful.
All that and more. And of course, for Mind Food giveaways, jump on to mindfood.com. You're listening to Mind Food Radio.
Mind Food Radio. Smart Thinking, the perfect gift idea, is a Mind Food magazine subscription. Visit mindfood.com today.
It's Mind Food Radio, and it's now time for my story.
That's right. I'd like to welcome to the show Phil Britton. He is a Bali bomb survivor. And Phil, I take my hat off to you. You've had an extraordinary life, and over to you to tell us your story.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a long 10 years, I suppose, but it's definitely had its highs and lows. You never forget, you always remember, but time does heal ever so slightly. You know, you learn to move on a little bit, but there's still and always will be for the rest of my life the what if, you know, the lives that were left behind, especially seven of my closest friends were so tight-knit, that Kingsley Footy Club group that we went over there with, and some of them were like 18 years old, 19 years old, so it's tough.
And how long were you in Bali after the bomb attack?
The bomb went off at about 8 past 11 on Saturday night, and I flew out of Bali, I think it was probably Sunday, late night, early Monday morning, because I arrived in Darwin Monday morning. What happened was I was hidden away in Sangla Hospital in a little room, just hanging on to my life, and all my mates that were still alive were looking for me and the others. And this stranger came in the room and asked me if I was his friend. Obviously, with the burns and everything, I was unrecognisable. And he asked me if I was his friend. I said, no. He said, does anyone know you here? And I said, I don't think so. I managed to get my mum's phone number to him. He called my mum, put her on the phone, and I, in a very husky voice, because of obviously the smoke inhalation, slowly whispered, Mum, I'm okay. I'm just a little bit burnt. I'm going to come home. I'll be okay. I knew I was telling her a lie. I knew I was bad. I knew I was really burnt, but I didn't want her to worry. Once my mum found out, she was on the first flight over there and was by my side for the 2.5 months that I was in the ICU.
And how was that initial meeting when you saw your mum?
I woke up from an induced coma and saw her above me. I still couldn't talk because of the tubes in my mouth, etc. But I looked up and I didn't really know if I was alive or I was in heaven because, you know, seeing your mum for the first time and in the way that I was, I didn't know if she was an angel or it was my mum.
So for people listening today and hearing your story and how dramatic a change your life has taken through a truly horrific thing that happened to you,
yeah,
what do you say to those people that perhaps they feel, you know, they're not on the right path or they're not happy with their life and, you know, they're not going to have an extraordinary, horrific thing happen to them? What do you say to those people?
Look, I say life's tough and you're never, ever going to cruise through it. It's like the old saying that there's lots of peaks and valleys in life. We have that saying in martial arts. There's times where there's no light at the end of the tunnel. And there's times where you cruise by. But I think it starts and ends with your mindset. You've got to believe in yourself first before anything else comes. You've got to believe that you can recover from whatever it is that it might be. You've got to believe that you can be something in life. And then once that change in mindset is there, then everything just starts falling into place.
Have there been any survivors through that Bali experience, and I'm not, that perhaps have not been so successful that you have come across?
I've met and I know of survivors. You know, it's tough because you had the people who got physically injured and, you know, they had their own battle and their own mind that they had to fight. But then you have the guys that were there in it, and they got out relatively unscathed, but they saw a lot. And mentally, I think, and emotionally, they were scarred, probably even more so than we were. And I think that sort of can haunt them for a lot longer.
Yeah. Now, the name of your book is?
Undefeated.
Okay. By Phil Britton. And it goes into bookstores. Is it in there now or it's about to go in, I think?
The book launch is on the 26th of September.
Fantastic.
Good on you, mate.
Okay.
This is Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking.
It's Mind Food Radio. Emily Dupuche joins us talking about children and eating now, Michael.
That's right. Emily is the author of Food Babies Love. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Hi, how are you going?
Now, I take my hat off to you because you're a self-published author and a mother of three, and you've written this book with Time Poor Mothers in mind. So tell us a little bit more about the book.
It was a pet project of mine that I wrote the book when I was introducing my now four-year-old twins to solids.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having such a great time in the kitchen with them, developing new and interesting meals for them to eat. And then all of my mother's group started cooking them for their babies and then onto my friends. And they were all giving me really encouraging feedback. So I thought, you know what, why not share some of this with other parents and try to encourage them to cook good, fresh and varied meal options for their children.
Because looking at the book, it's not sort of bland food. You know, you have included herbs and mild spices, I guess, to excite those little palates.
That's right, that's right. I really believe that babies don't actually like bland food. And when people talk about having a fussy eater, it's more often than not because they do just give their babies really plain bits of, you know, steamed chicken and veg and no real flavour. And let's face it, nobody really wants to eat food like that. So by creating adaptations of family favourites, I've found that children just love it. They just keep gobbling it up.
So do you find you prepare yourself a different meal than you do the children, or is it one meal for the entire family?
A bit of both. It depends. My husband and I are big chilli fans. We love Asian food and, you know, are always putting lots of chilli in. So depending on what we're eating, but certainly when they were early on in their solids phase, there was a lot of separate cooking going on. But now it's, you know, I take a bit of theirs out and then saves me a bit of time having to prepare separate meals.
And being time poor, like how time consuming is it actually, you know, these recipes and making this sort of type of food for the kids?
Yeah, it really varies what you're cooking. Most of the preparation of the meals is really quick and easy, and then the cooking time comes down to what the recipe is. So I've created, for instance, a tagine, well, what I call a tagine, but it actually uses lamb mince and takes about 5 or 10 minutes to cook. So the name is, I've taken the flavours, the Moroccan flavour base, and just created a quick and easy version of. Then I've got some casseroles that need a couple of hours to cook, but that's because the meat needs to be nice and tender for babies, you know, gums or brand new teeth to get through. So it really depends on what you're cooking. There's also lots of tricks in there, such as the use of rice flakes for risotto so that mums don't have to stand at the stove.
So, Emily, tell me, when you're introducing children to food, not that I would know anything about this, I would presume that kids just like food. So I've heard the thing fussy eater before, but when you're looking at all these food items for kids, how much is enough? Like, what do you do about portion control and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's kind of hard to know, but you really need to be listen and look for the signals your baby's giving you. Some of them have, it's like adults, we all have different sized appetites and different requirements for our energy levels. So you need to ensure that for the first 12 months of your baby's life that their primary milk remains the number one source of nourishment, whether that's breast milk or formula milk. Mm-hmm. And then through the use of solids, you're really just introducing them to a variety of tastes and textures. Their solid food is not actually their number one source of nutrition until they're well into their second year. So just, you know, three reasonable sized meals a day, about half to one cup in volume is enough at each mealtime. And then you'll find if you can provide or expose your baby to as wide a variety of tastes and flavours in the first 12 months, every child without a doubt will get fussy around 2 or 3 years of age when they realise that they do actually have some independence that they can exert.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll come around full circle sort of around 4 or 5 years of age and start to settle back into a nice sort of healthy diet if you have given them that platform to develop from.
That's author of Food for Babies Love. And for more details, go to mindfood.com.
Thanks very much.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
You know, Michael, I've got a student that I teach. He reads 3 books at once and he uses a Kindle these days.
Oh, yes.
And I said, how do you remember where you're up to on what book? He said, no. He said, I just can do that. Can you do that?
No, I struggle reading.
Yeah.
I'd like to welcome to the show our author. In fact, our author and book of the month for next month in the magazine, Emily Maguire, author of Fishing for Tigers. Welcome to the show, Emily.
Hello, good to be here.
Now, listen, it's quite an interesting way how you came about this story, isn't it? Because you didn't really want to leave Vietnam, is that right?
Yeah, I went there. It was supposed to be just a three-month AsiaLink residency. So I was working with a publishing house there and doing a little bit of my own writing. And I just about 6 weeks into it, I just realised I was in love with the place. And I've travelled a lot and, you know, pretty much everywhere I've been, there's something that I find to like about it, if not love. But I'd never, ever felt this before. It was just like falling in love with another person. I just couldn't explain it. But it was real. And I really struggled with the idea that I had to come home, that I had to come back to Sydney. And from out of that came this book in which I'm managed to live for the last few years while I've been writing it. I've been able to keep putting myself back there.
But it has actually taken years to write, hasn't it? It's been at least 3 years in writing this book.
Yeah, I started it in 2008. And I mean, part of that is because I don't write full time. I have other work that I need to do and I teach. And part of it is because I wanted to keep going back and doing more research, as I convinced everyone around me I was doing. And so I've been back sort of once a year for at least a month since 2008.
Now, the book is set in Hanoi. Just take us through a little bit about the book without giving too much away.
The book, the protagonist of the book is a woman called Misha, who's a 35-year-old Australian woman who flees, I guess is the right word, to Hanoi to escape a violent marriage. And she sort of just chooses the place rather randomly without knowing anything about it, but she finds when she's there that she falls in love with it, much as I did, and sets up a really nice life for herself there. It's really quite easy to live in Hanoi these days, especially if you're a fairly wealthy, privileged Westerner. She has a group of expat friends. She doesn't really have any responsibilities. It's a pretty great life. And then into this comes the 18-year-old Vietnamese-Australian son of one of her expat friends. And through getting to know him and developing a relationship, she's sort of forced to confront some of the real kind of deeper issues about being a privileged, wealthy Westerner who gets about the world doing what you like.
Right.
Now, I've got to say, in terms of all your different trips there, did any of this remotely come near you in terms of the story itself?
The central relationship, no. However, I guess to me the really interesting thing is the tension between, you know, we here in the West are very big on this kind of rhetoric about following your desires and that we each have a right to really pursue our own happiness and, you know, to find ourselves. And this is kind of really familiar stuff for most of us and a really different context in Vietnam or a lot of Asian countries where people think about their responsibility to their family, to their community, to their country. And it's something I came up again and again. I've made really good friends now in Vietnam, but I've found that it's not, in the end, the language differences or sort of the shallow surface cultural differences. It's sometimes the differences that come up is this really deep thing about how we live our lives and what kind of things we choose to pursue and whether we're thinking about, you know, who am I and what do I want to do with my life rather than what's my responsibility to my family and my community.
I think you're dead right. Our deputy editor, Donna Duggan, loved this book. She has raved about this book. And as I said before, it is Book of the Month in our October edition of Mind Food. Emily, it's great to have you on the show today. And I look forward to reading it, I have to say.
Thank you very much.
It's Mind Food Radio with Ben and Michael, and of course, for any stories that you hear on our radio program, jump onto mindfood.com. Now we're talking fitness. We've got TJ joining us on the line.
Hi, TJ. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Now, listen, at the age of 18, you were actually struck down with meningococcal and later suffered fairly severe depression. Now, these days, you're a lifestyle and health coach, but take us back to those days and this extraordinary transformation.
Yeah, unfortunately, back when I was 18, I was pursuing a football career or rugby league career and contracted meningococcal by sharing some drink bottles. It was really unfortunate and random, I guess, but I ended up in intensive care for 3 months and flatlining three times. And I guess, you get a bit of a lifestyle realization when that happens. Unfortunately, my football career was kind of taken away from me, which sent me into a little bit of depression. I gained a good 30, 35 kilos, and from there, it took me about 6 to 9 months to actually snap out that my life wasn't over and there's more to life than playing football.
Mm. TJ, can you walk us through what it's like, the symptoms of what you went through and your diagnosis and how that, you had to deal with that, I suppose?
I was playing in Canberra at the time, and I had been up visiting a friend in Cronulla who was playing for the Sharks, and I was feeling a little bit nauseous that one night, and I was having a headache, and I actually vomited a couple of times. I thought it was maybe dehydration, or I really wasn't sure it could be food poisoning. And the next morning I had a shower, and the next thing I knew, I was woken up and I was in hospital. What actually happened is I passed out in the shower. He called the ambulance. They sort of came down and knocked down the door and got me, and they said within about 2 minutes I would have died if they had came later. And like, I just kept coming in and out of consciousness for the next, I guess, couple of weeks. It was obviously, I didn't really know what was too much was going on at the time, but I'm grateful for the guys in the Sutherland Shire for looking after
me. So in a way, it wasn't your time. Someone was watching over you.
How did you actually pull it together?
Well, I'm originally from Perth, so after coming out of hospital, I went back to trial again and then had did my knee and tore my meniscus, so it took me out again, which then that's what sent me into a little bit of depression. My body really just couldn't, my body couldn't take it anymore. So I went home and I just felt sorry for myself, and like, I really didn't do anything for a good three to five months till one of my mentors, who's in the fitness industry and was a strength and conditioning coach, he pretty much came over and said, like, you know, your life's not over. You might not be about to be playing football anymore, but there's more to life, and maybe you should come down and help him help people get their results. So what I did was I went to TAFE for a couple of years, and at the same time was part-time working with him, and I found that that was a passion of mine to help people get to the results that they can't get by themselves, and that's what took me into the fitness industry.
Now, you're the founder and owner of Results-Based Training Australia. Now, what does that actually mean?
Result-based training is my facility in South Melbourne. We're just looking at opening up our next two facilities in the next 2 months. So it's a strength and conditioning and fat loss gym. So we help people get stronger, we help them get fitter, and we transform their bodies at the same time.
And what's the point of difference? So what's the difference to your gym than someone else's?
I guess the difference with our gym, what we do is we guarantee results. If we can't get your results in a specified time that we work out with you, then we'll train you for free until we get you there.
Wow.
It's guaranteed results, which doesn't happen at too many gyms anymore. You know, people come in, they check in, and they with most gyms, and they just come in, they use the cardio machine, they leave, and you know, 12 months later, they've paid, you know, $1,000 or $2,000, and their body hasn't changed at all. So they just think they're destined to be overweight and unhealthy for life. Whereas we take it more of an individualized approach and make sure that every single person coming into the gym has their goal plan and make sure we achieve them in a timely manner.
Hey, listen,
TJ, thanks.
Thanks for being on the show today.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Good stuff.
I'll take the tennis racket now.
Yeah, I think I'll just go back to reading about exercise in the magazine.
Mind Food Magazine and Mind Food Radio. Together, smart thinking.
And we're talking breast cancer now. We have the CEO of the National Breast Cancer Foundation on the line, Carol Renouf. Hello, Carol.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, Carol. Very good. And now, listen, I understand that the National Breast Cancer Foundation was established in 1994 and $81 million has been awarded to fund over 300 Australian-based research projects. That's pretty extraordinary since launch, isn't it?
Yes, it's a good deal of heavy lifting that's got us there over the years. Mm. And of course, you know, fundraising is getting ever harder.
Mm.
But really, we were founded to try and make the most profound difference that we can through research in terms of changing the future for people with breast cancer. So that's our goal.
The statistics seem pretty horrific, though, even still. And I know so much has been done in the area of breast cancer, but isn't it something like 38 Australians are diagnosed each day and 8 are losing their battle? That still seems very high.
Yeah, look, it's interesting. You can kind of look at that, you know, either of two ways. So the mortality rates have come down extraordinarily in recent years, or whichever way you want to put it, the survivorship rates have gone up.
Yeah.
And they're amongst the best in the world now, in fact, in Australia. So the progress, you know, made in terms of what research has brought has been extraordinary.
So what are we doing differently, do you think, that has helped that research?
In Australia, I think it's been number one in terms of medical research generally, actually not just breast cancer. We do tend to punch above our weight, particularly in the sort of area of, you know, basic research and also new treatments, that type of thing. But it's also been, to give them their due, that we have a very good free government breast screening program. So our early detection rates have been very good.
Why are the stats so big with women getting breast cancer, though? Like, what do you put it down to?
I don't think anybody has one answer, but look, there's a number of issues. Obviously, two of the greatest risk factors are, number one, being a woman, and that's to do with our kind of hormonal makeup, and a lot of breast cancers are related to what's happening with the hormones, not all of them. But and the second highest risk factor is age. So, you know, in a way, it's the curse of affluence that as we are living longer and longer, the chances of something going wrong in terms of the way our cells replicate increase. And that's basically what is at the root of cancer.
Now, early detection, of course, is important, but what should women be looking for?
Well, there's some very interesting studies, you know, that have come out in the last few years, really establishing much stronger links now than, you know, previously thought, much stronger correlations in a negative sense between breast cancer risk and consumption of alcohol. And obviously, I mean, you know, anything above very moderate consumption not that you can't have any. And on the positive correlation side, very strong links now being established around the protective effect that regular exercise and keeping to a good body weight can have.
Yeah.
And of course, we are seeing, nobody really knows the reason why, but we are starting to see an increasing incidence of breast cancer among younger women because it typically has been a disease of women aged 60 to 80. But you are now having, I think it's about 800 women under 40 reporting with it per year.
So in terms of the physicality of it, what should women be looking out for?
It's essentially a matter of monthly breast checks and, you know, in between any kind of change in appearance or texture or sort of feel of the breast.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, mind you, you know, we keep stressing women, but that applies to men too.
Yeah, well, actually, in terms of percentages, what is that with men in terms of getting breast cancer?
Yeah, it's about 100 men a year in Australia, so it's relatively small, but, you know, it obviously has, you know, a very big impact on them also.
Yeah. Look, Carol, it's great to have you on the show today, and thank you very much for highlighting this issue. So, yeah, we wish you all the best.
Thank you very much.
This is Mind Food Radio, smart thinking.
And welcome back to Mind Food Radio with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr. Very interesting interview now coming up, Michael.
It sure is. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark Kielberger. He is the co-founder of Free the Children. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us what Free the Children is all about.
Free the Children is a Canadian-based and founded organization that's now gone global. It was actually started by my younger brother, Craig, when he was only 12 years old and he was in grade 7 and read about the story of another 12-year-old boy from Pakistan who spoke out against child labor and was killed for speaking out. He, as a result, took a bunch of basically friends who were in grade 7 and 12 years old, came together and said, we wanted to start a club in a school, and they called up a very well-known human rights organization, and that person on the other end of the phone said, do you know where your parents keep their credit card? And my brother said, no, we want to help, we want to get involved, and that's how Free the Children was born, as a group of 12-year-olds dreaming to change the world.
And is Craig still involved in the business?
He is. So he actually asked for my help the next week, and that was 17 years ago, and it's continued to grow. And we have a look back. We have about 1.7 million members. We have about 4,000 schools actively engaged throughout North America. And overseas, we've been able to build over 650 schools, and we provide education to 55,000 kids every single day.
And where are the schools built? So whereabouts around the world are they actually built?
Kenya, India, Sierra Leone, Ecuador, Nicaragua, various regions as well in Latin America and South America, but they're all very poor. One of the countries we've worked in for a long time, for example, is Haiti, a country that remains very volatile and very challenging. And what we try to do is make sure that kids themselves have the chance to actually go to school, and we mitigate all the barriers preventing them from going to school, and as a result, break the cycle of poverty.
And so what are some of those barriers for them?
Well, the number one reason why girls can't go to school in sub-Saharan Africa isn't because there's no school. It's because they actually have to get water for their village. So it's great to go build a school, and we do that. But if you don't provide water at the school, girls aren't going to school. And then, of course, last but not least, what we don't want to do at all is make people aid-dependent on us. So we implement something called alternative sources of income. We actually empower women in the communities so that they actually have enough income and enough capacity through microloans, microcredits, and financial literacy training, so they can actually then run the projects themselves because they're deriving enough income to actually make this financially sustainable.
So when you start a project, do you begin with working with local council or local government?
We actually go directly to the local communities themselves. Yep. Yes, of course, we have to tie in local government to a certain extent, but that's certainly not our starting point. But we try to bypass governments as much as possible. We go right to the communities. We say, okay, here's what we can do. What can you do? And we have a long conversation.
Is it hard to get the local kids on board with something like this?
We've been doing this for 17 years, and in Canada we're seeing a generational shift. One of the things that we do up here, up north here, is these amazing stadium-like events called WE Days, so W-E, WE Days. And what we do is we do 8 of them across the country, and we every year bring 20,000 kids from 1,000 schools per event. I mean, again, we do 8 of these events in places like Toronto and Vancouver and Calgary and Winnipeg and Montreal, and we bring the greatest social justice leaders of our time and the greatest entertainers of our time. We have people like, oh my goodness, Bishop Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama, and great entertainers like Justin Bieber and, again, Nelly Furtado and The Wanted and all these amazing people. And we do these events across the country, and these kids, you can't buy a ticket. The corporate sponsors pay for the event, but they actually have to earn their way in through service. And so now we're seeing this incredible generation of kids that know it's cool to care. They want to participate for all the right reasons on top of that. And we're seeing incredible generational shifts because it's cool to care and they want to participate.
It's a wonderful cause.
It is. Mark, thank you very much. Co-founder of Free the Children organization. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Mind Food Radio. Smart thinking with Michael McHugh and Ben Starr.
Birthdays are in the air.
It sure is, that sense of celebration. And, you know, food is one of the most popular things within MindFood, both online, and you can sign up for our daily recipe and in the magazine. But Michelle, our food director, we've got on today's show. We're phoning her at home. What are you up to, Michelle?
Well, would you believe I'm getting ready for my daughter's 20th birthday tomorrow night. She's got friends coming over. It's looking like rain outside, so we're not too sure, but so I'm going to cater some nice warm food, I'm thinking.
What are you having?
So is it all from the pages of Mind Food?
It is. I'm looking at the issue that's on sale at the moment. It's the September issue, and we've got a beautiful recipe in there for sage, pork, and fennel sausage rolls.
Oh, my goodness.
They look beautiful, and so we're going to definitely have some of those. We're going to have some of the nice sage and prosciutto mounts, which is in the issue as well, and so something a little bit fresh, we're going to make some spicy chicken rolls.
Now, how do you make those? Yeah.
Well, I'm going to tell you how to make the sausage rolls.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we like that. Is that easy?
That sounds easy.
The sausage rolls are easy, and we've given the readers a really easy recipe.
Yep.
Basically, you go to your butcher and get some pork and fennel sausages, which you just split the skins open, add in some Dijon mustard, Worcestershire sauce, some fresh, beautiful sage, which is in season in the garden now, and some quince paste. You mix all that up and divide it into we've divided into four, and wrap it in a puff pastry. Brush the top of the pastry with a nice egg wash and make sure you seal the pastry, and then put a beautiful sage leaf on top. So it's a bit of a fancy sausage roll.
Mm. Now, what does the sage leaf do? Does that give it flavour?
Flavour? Yeah, it does. It's a beautiful taste. Is that one of your favourite herbs?
I love sage.
I love sage.
It's actually really easy to grow sage.
It is.
Isn't it?
It is. It's an easy herb, and at the moment it's in the garden, and then once the warmer weather starts to come, you just chop it back, and you know, it'll be ready for next year for you.
So what What's the toasted sandwich one with sage? What do you do there?
Oh, that's another nice easy recipe.
Prosciutto melts.
Yeah, there we go. So again, we're just going to get some cheeses together. We've got the Gruyere cheese, Parmesan and mascarpone. We'll mix that with a little bit of our Dijon mustard. Sorry, got that wrong.
Yeah.
And then mix that all together and put that inside between two slices of bread. And then we wrap the whole sandwich with the prosciutto and then again with some sage leaves on top. So it looks beautiful.
They look beautiful in the magazine. You just want to look at them.
They do. So they're on page 109 and 110 of the September issue.
It's on sale now. And if you're loving sage, we've also got a beautiful recipe for trout and sage.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. Yes, so are you doing that tomorrow night?
No way.
Too much preparation.
I'll take your food all the way.
What are you doing for like dessert tomorrow? Are you doing a big birthday cake?
Well, we're actually going to do. We've been over to Europe recently, and we're in the markets, and they had the most amazing stacks of chocolate brownie, and they were just all stacked up. So I thought, how easy is that? I'm going to make 5 chocolate brownies and just stack them up in one big cake, and then just a bit of dusting of icing sugar, and that's the cake.
Wow, I thought you might have been, you know, with your culinary delights in the kitchen doing a croquembouche or something.
Sounds like a modern day.
It'd still be stuck to my fingers.
Exactly, there's no time for that. So it's already cut up, is it, the chocolate brownie, and so then
it's just going to be slabs. I'm just going to bake them in the oven. I'll do five batches, and then it's just cooling them on the wire racks and then just stacking them up.
How lovely.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool.
Well, have a wonderful birthday party night.
Thank you. No, we're really looking forward to it. We've just run around with the duster, so the house is looking ready, and I've been to the supermarket, so now it's just cooking.
Oh, gosh.
Good stuff. I love party food though, don't you?
Yeah, it's Michael's so excited. His finger, he's got the book closed, the magazine's closed, and his finger is still stuck on the sausage roll page.
I actually want to look at it.
Oh, Michelle, well, look, have a wonderful night at the birthday party. Happy cooking.
Thank you.
I tell you what, they're great recipes, aren't they?
Get your finger out of the page there, Michael. This is Food Radio. Now, Michael, you love running, don't you? We love going for long runs, don't we?
Running away from
running.
We've
got a guy on the phone that's already run a couple of hundred Ks, and he's about to do 1,000 Ks by the end of it.
Well, I'd like to welcome to the show Dan England. Now, he is a stroke survivor, and part of his, I guess, challenge to himself was running 1,000 Ks. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Where are you running to?
You're actually halfway through, or perhaps a quarter through. How much have you run so far?
I've just passed 400 kilometres.
Oh, how are you feeling?
Good. Yeah, I guess as good as can be expected.
And where are you running to?
We are running to the Wesley Hospital in Brisbane.
And where have you run from?
Emerald, Queensland.
Wow.
If it was Michael and I, it would have been from the hospital entrance.
Well, if you don't run, you may end up there one day. How's that?
That's it.
Now tell me, who are you running with, or are you all on your lonesome?
I'm on my lonesome.
Wow.
I've got the wife and the two kids in the motorhome, and we're just following the course sort of through the outback here, looking for little groups in the communities to talk about stroke.
Now, let's take a few steps back. May 16 of last year, you joined 60,000 other Australians in having a stroke. You're 39 years old, and you're an avid runner for many, many years. You had no previous medical reason to have a stroke, and after 3 days in the Wesley Hospital, was told that you had a hole in your heart since birth that allowed a blood clot to pass through and cause the stroke. Take us from there, but take us how all that happened.
Well, I guess my story is similar to everyone's, and that is the stroke finds you. You don't exactly find the stroke, but I was getting ready for work just like you probably did this morning, and I just had a stroke. You know, I was getting dressed when the first symptoms came on, which was just a bit of dizziness and a humming in my ear, to then having full-blown numbness on the whole left side of my body while looking at the computer. So it's amazing to think that so many of the people that I spoke to have the same sort of silent stroke just coming on board. So,
now, did you know it was a stroke at that time and that you needed to get medical attention?
I didn't. I had a hunch, but I sat on the office desk feeling it come on, sort of like your arm went to sleep during the night. You wake up somewhere in the middle of your arm going dead, and you wake up and you think, gosh, what's wrong with my arm? And then you move your fingers, and nothing got any better, and it just continuously felt more numb. So I hopped on one leg to the couch and yelled to the wife, and we both sort of had the same hunch, possibly stroke, because it's on the one side. So we Googled signs of stroke, and the National Stroke Foundation website came up with FAST, and it just came out that my arm was numb and my face was numb, and it looked like it could be a stroke.
How hard has it been for your wife and family to see you go through this?
Well, I mean, I think they're happy to see me go through the run. As far as the stroke, I think everybody's really happy to see that you can go from being totally not, I wouldn't use the word disabled, totally unable to help yourself, to then being able to run marathons day after day after day. And it's a message that our Dan's Fast Run really wants to get out to all stroke survivors is, You can get better. It may not be running marathons, but if it's speech or if it's memory, just practice the rehabilitation and you will see results.
Dan, great to have you on the show. For our listeners listening, you can follow Dan's progress on mindfood.com. And for more stories about Stroke Australia and the great work that they're doing, also head to mindfood.com.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Well, that party food sounds fantastic. Michelle certainly knows how to cook up a storm, doesn't she?
I tell you what, I'm going home to make those sausage rolls.
Yeah, I know. And then TJ giving us some advice on fitness.
Isn't that an extraordinary story, though?
Yeah,
you know,
big story.
He's been so sick at 18, and look what he's done. Mm. Those transformation stories are extraordinary. Mm. You know,
well, the real tearjerker today was Bali.
I know, Phil, he was an extraordinary story, wasn't he?
Well, that's it. The show is at the end, Mind Food Radio. So, Michael, until next week.
We'll see you next week.
See you next week. And, of course, for more details on anything that you've heard on today's radio show or programs in the past, jump onto mindfood.com. And, of course, there's also some great competition prizes there as well, mindfood.com. Until next week, take care. Have a safe one.
Mind Food Radio, Smart Thinking, was produced in the studio of Radio Australasia. Produced by Ben Starr and Brian Newington and Patrick Kayrouse. Bogart Torelli speaking.